Welcome, you're listening to the Mac Observer's Background Mode. This is your host, John Martellaro, and this week my guest is computer historian, author, David Grealish. David, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, John. Thank you for having me.
Hey, thanks for being on the show. You have come to our attention in the past because you're a computer historian and I have talked. We both worked for Apple. You're a noted writer and podcaster. We published one of your interviews with John Sculley.
Yes.
We've known each other for quite a while, and I thought it would be cool to have you on the show.
Thank you. I concur.
Let's talk about computer history. I imagine that when you were younger, because we do this in background mode, as the listeners know, when you were younger, I imagine you didn't think about becoming a part-time computer historian when you got older.
No.
And one of the things we talk about is, you know, how people arrive at the point in their life where they arrived and how things worked out and the people they knew and the things they did to get where they are. So tell me your career arc and how you became a computer historian, and quite a good one, in fact.
Thanks. And, you know, just and you bringing that up right now, it makes me sort of think a little bit about my childhood. So absolutely, I had no, you know, insight or intention to become a computer historian. I did have interest in computers as a little boy. And I always, that was something I thought that that's going to be a part of my life when I get older, that it really intrigued me. But frankly, I didn't spend a lot of time in the 1970s when I was a little boy pursuing that much. Of course, you know, personal computers didn't really come out too much later. But you know, one thing I did as a little boy, I used to break out our 1957 Encyclopedia Britannicas, and I would just sort of eat them up, just like pull a volume out and just flip through them. And I was particularly interested in like old ships and submarines and any type of transportation. So now I think about it, I guess I always had a sort of an interest in history. So then jumping ahead, what kind of was the inspiration, I guess, for me getting into computer history was my first, what I call real computer. It's the first full computer I had that I could actually do work on, because I had a hard drive and I could put modern software on it and do things. I actually did have a Commodore 64 for a little while, which I loved, but I couldn't do a lot of productive stuff on it. But it was an Apple Lisa. And basically, I worked for an Apple dealer. I was in college and I worked there part time. And I really wanted a Macintosh. This is 1989. And even with a discount, there's no way I could afford one. Then one day, this guy came in the front door and with what looked like this giant Mac. And then he carried it over to the service department. And I saw, like, kind of semi saw it. So after the guy left, I walked over there and talked to the service tech. And like, what is that? And it turned out to be a Mac XL, it was called, but an Apple Lisa. And so that just intrigued me. And
so for the listeners who may not remember the Lisa, you know, for maybe they go back to the Mac a ways, tell us about what the Lisa was, its origins.
So Apple had, you know, huge success with the Apple II. The Apple II completely paid all the bills and made all the huge profits for Apple for a long time, well into even the launch of the Macintosh. In any case, around the late 70s, they started thinking that, you know, we can't just depend on this one machine. You know, we got to create a new machine. There's got to be a successor for the Apple II. And Apple kind of got a little too caught up, and it had to be a business machine. So they developed two sort of other machines, the Apple III, and then they decided to make another machine called the Lisa. And then there's a lot of history I could go into about this, but let's just say that it was inspired by the way it turned out was inspired by a visit to Xerox PARC and how it turned into a graphical user interface computer with a mouse.
So the Apple III was sort of the Apple II team's vision of the next generation machine. Sleeker, cooler, better operating system.
But still a business machine.
Yeah, and we all know about the heat overheating issues because Steve wouldn't let him put a fan in it, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then there was the Steve Jobs thing that you just referred to, where he saw the machine that's a Xerox Palo Alto
Park.
Research Center Park, which inspired him to start with the Lisa. How much did that thing cost?
So, and it had huge cost overruns, budget. I believe it cost Apple $50 million in development costs.
I mean, how much was the user price?
Well, it was $10,000.
Oh,
so
my God.
It was released in January 1983.
1983, $10,000.
Was
inflation
crazy.
Adjusted.
Right.
Oh, wow. Who could buy that?
So needless to say, it wasn't a big success. And again, so much history and stories to tell here, but keep it short. Basically, Steve Jobs was bossing people around and getting a little too in people's faces, and he basically got booted from the Lisa project. So he decided he was going to start another project, and he basically took over the Macintosh project and made it into a cheaper Lisa. So that's at the beginnings of the Macintosh, is he wanted to compete, like he'll show them, which I guess he did to a certain extent, and he'll make a faster, cheaper, better Lisa. And that's where the Macintosh came out of that, which of course was introduced a year later from the Lisa in January 1984. So when that happened, Apple took the Lisa, rebranded it the Mac XL or Macintosh XL, and they came up with some software called MacWorks, which allowed the Lisa to emulate and run the Macintosh software. And but then somewhere around...
Could you switch back and forth easily?
No. Well, yes, you could on the original Lisa, because you could. It was a piece of software, so you could just run MacWorks, and then you could run Mac software, and then, or you could go back and run the Lisa software because it was running under Lisa OS. But getting back to mine, so jump forward a little bit. So basically, Steve Jobs, before he left Apple, one of the key things he did was kill the Lisa altogether. He said, I don't want this involved anymore. I don't want anything to take focus off of the Macintosh. And that kind of sounds familiar because he sort of had the same attitude about Apple,
too. Well, that was smart because nobody could afford it. And as I recall, Steve wanted to sell the original Mac for like $19.95. He thought people could afford that.
Well, and ironically, though, the Mac XL had come as low as $3,500, still a lot of money in 1985, but it was actually selling really well because it had a full megabyte of RAM, it had a hard drive, and it had a 12-inch screen. And so compared to the Mac 128, or even the 512, it was worth the extra money. So basically, it got canceled. Apple made a deal with a company in Logan, Utah called Sun Remarketing. And actually, I interviewed the president of that company, which is really interesting. If anybody has an interest in that, his name is Bob Cook. But so his company took on all these Apple leases, and they took new old stock Apple leases, and they were selling them as Macs. So fast forward to December 1989. That's basically what I ended up buying. I looked in the back of Macworld and Mac User Magazine, saw an ad. And I was intrigued by the Lisa, and I was like, wow, this is cool, and it could be my first Mac. It was $1,095 versus about $1,800 it would have cost me for a Mac Plus with a hard drive. And that became my first Mac.
It's funny how we fixate on machines. We have a dream machine.
Mm-hmm. Well, it was a great machine.
Yeah.
I mean,
it moved an inspiration.
Well, I mean, for me personally, I moved into desktop publishing. I taught myself Quark Express while I worked at the Apple dealer because everybody else knew PageMaker. And I went on to have a desktop publishing pre-press career for a while before I became a computer tech, which I am today. But so basically that machine as my first Mac, which was really a Lisa, I was so just in love and intrigued with it that I just started looking into its history, and then that sort of just kept blossoming into the history of Apple, the history of the two Steves, Steve Wozniak and Steve Jobs, and ultimately the history of personal computers. And then I just like loved the whole topic, and it was all exciting and new to me, just all those stories. These are the pioneering days of the microcomputer, and I kind of wished I could have been involved in it, and it allowed me to do that secondhand, I guess.
Well, then you got a diversion right there, right after 1989. You told me that then you went into the Army.
Yeah, so about I was pretty happy with just my Lisa and Apple history and stuff, but more and more I was reading and getting more into computer history, buying books and reading and so on. But then I joined the Army in late 1990 and got married. My life changed quite a bit, moved to Germany, lived there for a little under 2 years.
You met your wife in the Army, you told me.
Yeah, at Fort Gordon, Georgia. And then we both went to Darmstadt, Germany for just about 2 years.
I've been in Darmstadt. Mm-hmm. Yeah, in 1984, my wife went to Germany on business, and I strung along, and after she was done with her army business, and then we visited Darmstadt and Eberstadt and Heidelberg.
Yeah, beautiful. Yeah. And Darmstadt is, for anybody listening, is just kind of outside of, now I'm going blank.
Not too far from Frankfurt, I don't think.
Thank you. I had Hanau in my head, but yeah, Frankfurt.
Yeah.
It's like 40 or 50 clicks, they say, kilometers from Frankfurt.
Yeah.
And I joined my first Macintosh user group in in Germany in the military, and it was in Kaiserslautern, which is pretty cool, mostly Americans involved in that. So
what was the state of the personal computer industry in Germany compared to the United States in 1990? Do you recall?
Well, I visited one Apple dealer in Darmstadt, and it was kind of, you know, I never really learned too much German, and you know, most people could speak decent American, but it wasn't, you know, their prices were really high, and of course I could just buy them mail order, and I'd pay normal American shipping, you know, they'd ship it to a military base. Mm-hmm. But it was very exciting, but I wasn't involved really in the German side. You know, I mean, like I didn't run into a German user group. It was pretty much all American service people in this Mac user group, but it was very active. But you know what? It made me think I made some good friends with some neighbors. We didn't live on post. We lived in a German neighborhood, and I became friends with the man and his wife because he had an Apple sticker on his car. And it's funny, my wife, she saw that and she goes, oh, you guys will be friends.
Yeah. And, well, it wouldn't be so much a big deal in the United States because everybody gets those stickers in the box. But when it's 1990 or so and you see one of those on a German car, you go, oh, mm-hmm. I got to get to know this guy.
I even bought him when we went on vacation, like a year later, we got to know them, real nice couple. And I actually bought him a PowerBook 100. In the United States, and then you know he paid for it, of course, and then brought it back for him because it was cheaper than buying it in Germany, and I don't think that was anything wrong with that, but anyway.
Do you still have that, Lisa, that you bought for $1,000?
So I don't. I had it for a long time. I really loved it and stuff. There. This is kind of sad, but it's kind of good too. There were times in our lives with we have three children ultimately, but we had kids, and there were some times we got out of the military where finances became tight, and so I actually sold that on eBay, and I was very active on eBay.
Can I ask you how much you got for it?
You know, I made a profit on it. I want to say I sold it for probably like $1,400, $1,500, if I remember correctly.
Oh, nice.
And I have a Lisa now, and I'm restoring it.
We mentioned that the other day that you were restoring. I didn't get a chance to ask you about that. What does restoration mean? Does it mean cleaning the plastic with a toothbrush, or does it mean mechanical replacement of parts, or what does that mean?
Well, I guess. So I'm a computer tech, and I'm reasonably technical to a point. You know, I'm not like, so, you know, the answer to your question, no, I'm not going in and like replacing capacitors, the electronics. That's over my head. But I did go in and make sure everything's functioning properly. And also with Elisa's, the entire card cage can slide out of the back. And then I just basically make sure the chips are seated well, the boards are seated well, make sure it functions. So
what if
it does.
The floppy drive failed? I bet you can't get those anymore, right?
You can, but like anything on eBay, you can pay a premium for it. And there's people out there that know how to like lubricate those and adjust them. I don't. In fact, does my floppy drive work? I'm not sure.
They know how to remove the paper clips too.
I need to tell that story, huh? My hard drive failed. And so there is a flash based solution that you can get for the Lisa. It's not cheap. It's about $370, but it basically allows you to run Lisa software off of flash SD card.
Oh, that's cool.
You can bypass all the mechanics, you know, that obviously fail. Those are the first things that fail in a lot of old computers are floppy drives and hard drives. So, but then otherwise, yes, pretty much make things work well, clean them as far as blowing dust out, you know, and then cleaning them exterior wise, load them with software, make them function and so on. So that's what I'm doing.
Okay.
So that started the whole thing. And then just, what happened was we moved back to the States, still in the military, in the spring of 93. And then I had decided, you know, when I get back to the States, I think it'd be kind of cool to start actually try to find some of these old computers. And that was the beginning of me collecting old computers. And, you know, at different points in my life, I've had like, you know, a garage full of old computers and a room full otherwise. So, you know, it's like a little museum.
Cool. That's a good place for us to take a break because I need to run a short ad. So when we come back, I want to ask you about your continuing work and all the different things that you've done in computer history. So just folks, stay with us. We'll be back in 60 seconds.
Hello there, all you fabulous Background Mode listeners. I'm Kelly Gamont with the Mac Observer, and I just want to say a few words about how you can support all the things we do. If you're thinking about buying something from Apple, Amazon, or Mac Mall, just go to the Mac Observer's homepage where we have a section called Support TMO. Or you can just enter macobserver.com/Apple Store, all one word, and that will take you to our special page for Apple and our other affiliates. If you make a purchase from one of our partners this way, the Mac Observer receives a small compensation for sending business their direction. Pretty cool, right? And you don't pay a penny more. This small fee from our affiliates helps us continue to bring you TMO's daily news, reviews, tips, how-tos, and podcasts like this one. So the next time you're thinking about an online purchase, come to TMO's homepage and support the Mac Observer. Thanks. Back to you, John.
I'm chatting with computer historian and author David Grealish. So, David, you've come back to the United States. I think you said the other day you came back to, was it Fort Bliss?
Yes, in El Paso, Texas.
I used to be in my neck of the woods. Kind of lived a little north of there on the New Mexico side for a while. Got to know Fort Bliss really well.
Right. It's right next to Mexico.
That's the Air Defense Center for the United States, right? Because I worked on the Patriot Missile Simulator.
Well, I was in the Army, so generally there is an Air Force base right next to the Army bases, so I don't remember what the Air Force base was called there. But you're probably right, but that would have been on the Army base.
Well, the Patriot's an Army missile system, right?
Is it?
Yeah.
I'm not sure. Yeah, I was a radio repair person, so I'm not sure. And it was a long time ago.
But you started up a project there.
So I came back to the States, and I was on fire about starting to try to collect old computers, which I'd started a couple beforehand, and I had joined a CompuServe forum. So I'd gotten online for the first time in like 92 or whatever in Germany, but I could call a local number and be on the American CompuServe. And I'd actually acquired a couple old computers and had them sent to my mother's house in the States. So I was starting a collection. And once I was in the States, then, you know, now I could just get stuff because it was garbage. Most old computers, it was totally worthless that people just give it to me.
Did you go out of your way to collect things? Did you have like a list? Like I want a Sinclair.
Yeah. And this is pre eBay. So this is all me going to flea markets, thrift stores, and those like sales flyers. Remember, like they used to do newspapers with like ads and stuff.
Thrifty Nickel.
Yeah, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And I actually built up quite a collection. And so even then, when I got started, I think after about a year, I had an Altair, which is the first microcomputer. I had an MSI, which is sort of the first clone of the first microcomputer.
The Altair was interesting because it was it had toggle switches on the front,
right?
And each machine instruction was an 8-bit instruction, and what you had to do was you had to toggle the bits on and off until you formed the 8-bit command. And then press enter, and it saved. And that's the way you entered a single computer instruction. It was amazing.
Right. The first microcomputer, and in fact, whether you're a Mac user or a PC user, we are all using the legacy of that machine because it used the Intel 8080 processor, which is like the great-great-great-granddaddy of what we're all using now.
That's right, except for now we do billions of those instructions per second instead of one.
Right. I guess the next thing to tell you is I decided, you know, I think I'll start a club, and it wouldn't be like a local user group. It would be something online, and the community, I guess the voice of that would be a fanzine or a newsletter or a zine, you know, that I created. And so I joined AOL when we got to the States, and that was exciting because AOL was pretty cool, I thought, back then, you know, and it was had a nicer, more Mac-like interface than CompuServe. And so I started the Historical Computer Society, and then I started publishing a zine called Historically Brewed, which is a play on the Homebrew Computer Club.
Did you print that? Did you print it on a 9-pin printer, or did you?
So I had a
Z-wheel printer.
No. I had a remember I was a desktop publisher, so I had my Mac, and by then I had a regular Mac. I think I had a Performa 400 by then, and I had a desk writer. That was the HP inkjet before they just kept it just deskjet where it was compatible with both. They actually
had one of those. Yeah.
So I would do my layout between ClarisWorks and Cork Express, and then I would print out stuff on my desk writer, and then I would do what was called paste up. So literally print it out, cut it out, and paste it onto like a master piece of paper, you know, creating the pages. Now, in some cases, I could print the whole page, but I didn't have a scanner back then, so I couldn't scan something and put it all together in the computer. And then once I had the masters all done, then I would go to the mailboxes, et cetera, and sometimes I'd be there. I got an account because it was cheaper per copies, and I would then put them together so I could make the double-sided 11 by 17s, you know, to make then fold it, and I had to buy a long stapler. Then I put it all together by hand.
People forget that we went through those days. I remember we had a magazine in New Mexico called Peelings, and I remember doing wax board paste up. And you took these wax board sheets and you took them to the printer and they photographed them and then printed them out.
Right.
Wow.
Yeah, and as historically brewed
stone knives and axes.
As it evolved and matured, I did get the covers printed, and I introduced like a second color because I was doing, you know, grayscale, black and white. So like I think it was issue 5, I had like green, you know, black, and then red and black, and then the ultimately I was going to come out, I changed the name, and I decided to call it Classic Computing because it just made more sense. It was more clear about what it was, the magazine. And I had hopes of actually making it a real, like, legitimate magazine one day. And I printed those covers, and I took them to the print shop in full color covers. And I know I told you in an earlier conversation, then just life was complicated by then. Two kids and out of the military, probably the poorest we've ever been. And I didn't have any money to like finish that issue. It would have been issue 1 or issue 10 of the original name. And then that's where it all stopped, like around 1997, I guess it was. So I did 9 issues of Historically Brewed. And then basically it just kind of, as far as that went, it all stopped.
And then time stopped, and then it resumed. And as you told me the other day, you're back in Alpharetta.
And yeah, I live in the greater Atlanta area, so about 30 miles north of downtown Atlanta, and Johns Creek, which is right next to Alpharetta. Mm-hmm. And we moved here in 2009. And so things really sort of, so we'll jump ahead. Things really kind of started hopping more in my computer historian role once I moved here, because I tried a number of times. So before then, I lived in the Jacksonville, Florida area, my hometown. And I tried a few times to you know, get a new club going, another historical computer society, but, you know, with local user group. I just couldn't get enough interest. But once I moved here around 2010, I actually got some people to start showing up, and I founded a group called the Atlanta Historical Computing Society, which is a very active, successful group. And I'm no longer the president. I mean, I'm just the founder now, but it's one of my goals was to make it a self-sufficient, you know, self-governing, you know, user group. So it is. And then,
what is it about old computers or computer history that fascinates people? I mean, if you had to describe why people join the club and what their fascination and what drives them is, what's the explanation behind that?
I've got a good one. and it's interesting because psychologically, I think I'm sort of an oddball. The reason I got into it versus most people involved in it, I think a lot of collectors in general, but with computers, they either want to reacquire something they really loved, so they're one of the computers, their most beloved computer, they'd like to have it back.
Oh yeah, right? Yeah.
Or the one they never could have.
Right, like Alisa.
and there's two other sort of common denominators here that a lot of the and it's mostly men, a lot of the guys, well, there's some women involved, but a lot of the guys are generally either engineers or engineering oriented or programmers or developer type oriented people. And so that's, I don't have scientific hard facts about that, but that seems to be sort of the trend to me. But yeah,
like
I think all collectors.
Reasonable. Yeah.
That's why a lot of times for me, I guess I like to, I think what I kind of developed into, but early on is I'm really more of a cultural historian. So I'm really more fascinated. The machines are important and I'm fascinated by them, but it's more about the people and the stories and the culture around it.
That has led you to do some of the podcasts that you've done, interviews with John Scully and with Ed Roberts.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I'd really like to, mention that. So I interviewed Ed Roberts, who was the man who invented Altair, which is generally considered the first commercially successful microcomputer, which is what we call personal computers before we call them
computers. That even predated the Apple I, didn't it?
Yes. So it was announced in January 1975.
It was on the cover of Popular Science or something like that.
Electronics.
And people got all excited and they started ordering. And it came as a kit, right? You had to actually put it together.
At first, yeah.
Yeah.
It absolutely set the world on fire, at least in the United States initially, on personal computing and what it could do.
Speaking of cultural aspects, I remember that I lived through that time. I was in school. And the feeling was that you'd seen computers on television. You'd seen Star Trek, and you'd seen the shipboard computer, and you'd seen science fiction movies with computers and robots. And the concept, the prospect of having a computer of your own that you had control over, that you could build things with, was so appealing. It was an incredible experience and an incredible drive for people to want to have their own computer in their own house. Because before that, you were using a Casio calculator or a slide rule. So that was my motivation anyway.
Well, it was a very compelling concept also, right? The potential of what it could do, the Altair, the MITS Altair it was called, was so primitive and so limited in very many ways, but it was the genesis of personal computer.
But you were doing it. You had a computer in your hands, and you were programming it, and you were making things happen. Like, you were the starship captain of your computer.
Exactly. You could control this thing, which only, people in white lab coats in locked rooms, special permissions and access could do just a decade earlier.
Right.
And I think Star Trek did play a big role in that, and I still think Star Trek does. The future of where you can just walk up to a computer and, computer and just ask it a question.
It's driving this phenomena of Amazon Alexa and Siri, the lifelong dream to be able to chat and have a conversation with our computers. It's a cultural thing again. Yeah.
But I did interview Ed Roberts, and I have and years later I put up the audio from that. I did like a smaller transcript of it in one of my Historically Brewed, I guess it was the last issue. But you can go out and listen to that on my website, the interview, and it's really good because a lot of people don't realize that, and he doesn't get enough credit for his company MITS, which with the Altair, he didn't just pioneer the first personal computer. He actually pioneered like the first, one of the earliest computer magazines, first computer shows. A lot of people don't realize that both Bill Gates and Paul Allen started Microsoft as employees of Ed Roberts.
Their first product.
In Albuquerque, New Mexico, where was the Altair BASIC. And so his company and they had a lot to do with their future success, at least initially. So and he's not well known, which is kind of sad. And he's really sort of like the...
Well, that's because you're talking about Ed Roberts, right?
Ed Roberts, yeah.
Well, that's because, as you told me, he launched off on a different career, became a doctor.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it kind of fell out of the mainstream. Yeah, interesting. Well, in those days, you didn't know. I mean, I was a student, and I was thinking, boy, I should go to work for Microsoft. This is the future. But I was so immersed in my studies, and I was so enraptured with physics and astronomy that I felt like, this was the proper academic career path, as opposed to, packing up and moving to this, nickel and dime outfit in Redmond, Washington. So,
for me, the Mac was the future. The other thing, other than the computer history thing, I was just in love with Mac and Apple.
Oh yeah.
So that also drove everything. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I was running a computer magazine at the time, and we were able to get Macintoshes at half price. Otherwise, I'd never owned one. Yeah. So tell me about your computer quasi museum. You said you don't have a museum per se, a formal one, but you've got a lot of computers on hand still. Tell me about some of the things you have in your garage.
So I don't have so many now because I've scaled back and, I'm going to have three kids and busy life. And my wife had never parked in the garage until about about a year ago. And I actually promised her that I would get it to a place. So she parks in the garage now and she really loves that. And I'm happy to do that. We all get older too. And
it's still like, Elisa that boots up, runs Mac software.
Yep. So, yep. So I have a Lisa. No, it doesn't. It doesn't run Mac software because it has the original Lisa rectangular tall pixels. And actually, I take it back. It does run Mac. I could put the original MacWorks on it. But unlike my first Lisa, they had put what's called a screen kit on it, which made the pixels square like the Macintosh. And so its display looked like a real Macintosh display, but 12 inches. But when you do that, you can't run the Lisa software. I mean, you could run it. It just doesn't look right. So that was a screen repair. No, it's not called that. Screen, you know, kit that changes the pixels. But so I decided to scale back, and I have I love Commodore 64, so I have a original Commodore 64. They redesigned it where it looked more like an Amiga, so that's a 64C. I have that. I have one of the earliest computers I got from someone, and when I started collecting, and I was in Germany, and it's an SX64, the portable, which is really nice, with a little 5-inch color display. I love that computer. And then I have a Mac Plus, an external hard drive, and a bunch of stuff for that, software, Infocom games and stuff. Got the Lisa. I have an iMac G4 because I really like that particular one. I have a iMac
G4. G4 is that the makeup mirror one?
The one with the stand.
The floating display.
How do you say? Right.
I called it the makeup mirror. Some people call it the sunflower.
I have a PowerBook 1400. I think that's about it on my Macs. But then I have, I've moved into reproduction. So I have an Altair 8800. That's that first microcomputer. And it looks totally real from the outside, but it's emulated on the inside. So it's a full reproduction. And then I've got like a few other reproductions. And then just a few other miscellaneous. But yeah, going back, I have pretty much owned about every significant personal American computer there's ever been in the last 20 plus years. At some point, I've owned them. So, you know, and it's fun. But I came to the conclusion, like, especially about the garage, is when stuff's sitting on shelves in the garage and just it gets dusty constantly and I barely have time to do anything with them, it's not doing me or anyone any good. So I try to find them better homes with people actively, you know.
Yeah, and I can see how that translates into a career, more publication, cultural analysis, mm-hmm. podcasts, and things like that. We only have a few minutes left, so I wanted to finish up with asking you about your current efforts and projects and the writings that you've been doing in the podcast and so on. Tell me about that.
That's so much to tell. But yeah, so basically what I'm doing right now is I'm not doing anything right now, but I'll tell you about some stuff I've wrapped up recently. I was doing a podcast with my co-host named Jeff Salzman called The History of Personal Computing, and I think it's a really good podcast.
Can we get those on your website?
Yes. So if you just go to classiccomputing.com, mm-hmm. I have an About Me page, and there's links to all my podcasts. So there's
great,
that one.
Great.
I used to do one called Retro Computing Roundtable. It's actually still going with other hosts. You can also get to my notable interviews, like Ed Roberts. I also interviewed John Sculley.
Alan Kay.
Yeah, that was a written interview, but Alan Kay, really excellent. And then, of course, I mentioned Bob Cook, the Sunday Marketing guy, and there's a few other people. And then I've written a few articles I'm particularly proud of. One is where I compare Walt Disney and Steve Jobs, and they're obviously very different people in a lot of ways, but there's a lot of business similarities between them. So I like to point people that way. And when the 40th anniversary of the Mac, I wrote an article about did you know the Mac almost failed, and that's a good story. So, and there's a bunch of other articles. So yeah, lots of stuff there. Check it out.
All right, cool.
Well, and we'll get my book for free. Got to mention that.
Yeah.
Go there and download the PDF of my book, Classic Computing. That's got all the newsletters, fanzines in there, and my story, and free.
If anybody wants to do research on the history of computing, these are great resources.
Yep. All right. I call it the history of computer history nostalgia.
Well, this has been great. Trip down memory lane. So we're about out of time. I want to thank you very much for being with us and telling us about the good old days of growth and the history of computers and what you're doing. Tell the listeners how they can contact you if they wish, if they want to learn more or just ask questions.
I think the easiest way is, and it's an easy webpage, classiccomputing.com. And then from there, it's got my Twitter link on there. It's got my email. You can email me from there. It's pretty much the central place to see what I'm doing, you know, what I've done, and get a hold of me.
Great. Well, thanks, David, for being on the show. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, John. My pleasure.
Folks, we're glad you came by. We always appreciate you coming to listen to the Mac Observer's Background Mode. We'll see you next week.